Welcome to Microbios, the podcast about biology careers, brought to you by BioNavigators. In today's episode, we'll be hearing from Dr. David Rivers, a forensic entomologist and small college professor. So, Mike, imagine that there's been a murder on campus. Who's the first person you'd call?
Probably Dave Rivers, Dr. Dave Rivers.
I was hoping you'd say police and then I could say Dave Rivers, but yes. So we have an interview with a person who has a really, really cool job that revolts many people, plucking maggots off of dead things and then trying to figure out what that tells them about how the dead thing became dead. And he's also a college professor.
Yeah. And he's a pretty funny guy. So
he's okay.
Mildly funny.
What did you think about the interview that we did with him? What jumps out to you?
Just kind of his unique perspective. I mean, we did talk also about graduate school and how he went through that experience and how he even got to forensics. And, you know, it's an interesting to go from entomology to forensics is not a straight line. So I think that was something that was, you know, interesting. And his, you know, his side passion or whatever is Sherlock Holmes and mysteries. And so he's able to actually combine what his personal interests are with his science and his research that he's done. I think that's pretty phenomenal. And he's created this unique space for himself that I think is really interesting. And that, you know, I think a lot of students think that everything should be a straight line and you go, you know, you do this, and then you're happy. And in reality, you have to kind of bounce around a bit and find what works best for you.
Yeah. And it's interesting when we pushed him on that, he did see it kind of as a straight line. He saw one thing leading to the next, to the next, to the next. And as an outsider, I wouldn't have guessed that at all. So I think our students can learn a lot from this and kind of learn a bit about what a day in the life of, or what a career as a small college professor who also does research might look like. Yeah. So with that, let's listen to the interview.
Let it roll.
So for our first ever Microbios podcast, we're very fortunate to have Dr. David Rivers, which we just decided we would call Dave. And he has had a pretty impressive career. He graduated with a bachelor's degree from Ball State University. He got his PhD in entomology from the Ohio State University. Then went on to do an NIH postdoc fellowship in cellular and molecular parasitology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Came to Loyola in 2003. And has taught just a couple of courses. I might not have them all. Forensic entomology, forensic biology, general entomology, Poe, Holmes, and the evolution of forensic science, comparative physiology, invertebrate zoology, introduction to anatomy and physiology, general genetics, a seminar on seasonal adaptations of insects, and a special topics course on the coral reefs in Belize. Did I miss any there?
I don't know. I'm very interested in many of those courses, but no.
They sound fascinating, don't they? He also published two books, The Science of Forensic Entomology and Insects, Evolutionary Success, Unrivaled Diversity, and World Domination, which sounds incredible. He's mentored faculty, including the two on this podcast, mentored research students. He's been the chair and director of the undergraduate programs for the biology department. He created the forensic studies program, created what we think is the first ever master's degree program in forensic pattern analysis. He's done research on parasitic wasps, on physiology and behavior of forensically important flies. He's developed diagnostic tools. He's published in career development, even creating with Mike Tangria, the Mid-Atlantic Biology Research and Career Network. In 1 year, he won both the Transformative Teaching Award and the Scholar of the Year Award. And he apparently has a family that he can occasionally see as well. that's just impressive, Dave. And so what we're hoping to do today is to try and give people some insight into how you handle all of this and how you're prepared. So I wanted to start off by asking you, you know, you're at a small college as a professor, day in the life, and talk about the amazing way that graduate school prepares you to be a college professor.
Well, that will take forever, I think, to do that. How long is your podcast? So I appreciate the introduction. I have to do some fact checking to make sure that some of that is actually true. But the one thing I can tell you is that I have been here a little longer than you suggested. So 2003 was
just... Was that your return to Loyola?
That was my return to Loyola. Okay. I actually started in 1994. Way back when I was still just a wee pup. And actually, I think that was the second time I'd ever been to the East Coast. So I really didn't know what I was getting myself into. Not as a faculty member, and certainly not as living in the Mid-Atlantic region, which has become home, and I really love being out here as well. So a day in the life, how does grad school prepare you for teaching, a teaching career that involves research? It probably doesn't, would be the honest truth, or at least it certainly didn't when I was in school. I know that, the 2000s have had a lot of changes that have taken place in grad education, and I think we've seen that there are programs that try to teach people how to teach. You don't teach someone how to teach. It's got to be something that you're an individual who loves interacting with people, and you love interacting with young scientists that actually are learning the same things that you learned, and you want to be part of helping them achieve the same excitement. If that's not part of who you are, then you'll never really learn anything that will teach you to be that person. So in some sense, you're born to be a teacher, I think, or you're born to wanting to help people. And obviously teaching can come in many different forms. Grad school gave me the first introduction to what's it like to be in front of a group of students, because I went with the idea into grad school, I want a research career. I love doing research. I love doing it as an undergrad. And in my mind, I had a path worked out of where I was going to go. And I thought I wanted to have a long-term career in to work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which I think what they do is really cool. And I thought so then. And I wanted to be a research entomologist. And there were so many really cool projects that were going on at that time. And I graduated from undergrad in the 80s and then with my PhD in 93. So the USDA was the largest employer of entomologists. So it just made sense. And that was the path I was going to go. And then I got the chance to actually be a TA, which I thought was punishment. I really did. I mean, I didn't have a lot of experience with that from the standpoint that where I went as an undergrad, we were a large state school and that we had 20,000 undergrads or roughly around that. And TAs were used very sparingly. So you spent most of your time with your professors. So that's what I knew. So the idea that I was going to go, first year in graduate school, and I'm going to be in charge of a lab that undergrads in biology are doing, terrified me. Wanted nothing to do with it. Nothing I thought had prepared me for it, other than recognizing that some of the students, can't say all of the students, but some of the students liked biology as much as I did, or they were going down that path. And I didn't know you'd form that kind of connection. So turns out I liked it. So grad school exposed me to a career path. It didn't necessarily build all of the skill sets that I actually needed. But I will say that my graduate advisor at Ohio State was incredibly supportive of this path. And that was something I guess I needed more than anything. Because, there are experiences that you'll hear that folks get into a career path. They'll have a... And maybe it's in school, you have an advisor who's not supportive of that. And a lot of research faculty aren't thrilled to hear that their grads are going to go into a teaching career rather than a research to continue their legacy. And my advisor was interested in my legacy and what I wanted to do, and just kept teaching me life lessons that wasn't that sharp that I knew that's what was happening always. But I definitely can look back at it now and say that was an incredible experience to work with that person and to get that initial exposure.
That sounds fantastic. I mean, it sounds actually, in my experience, pretty rare to find someone that supportive of a non-research career, too.
I've heard stories from colleagues. I've heard stories from students who've gone to grad schools that sometimes that winds up being rare. I don't know if it was just unusual for where I was or my department, but entomology at Ohio State, the faculty were very supportive of all the ones I interacted with, I should say, which was quite a few. they were very supportive of their students going into a teaching career. And I thought it was incredible. But, you know, I think that in part that was because their department was active in teaching courses, maybe not to the same extent that we do at Loyola University, Maryland, the Loyola University, Maryland, but still they had an appreciation for it. And I think some of them really loved to do it. So I think that's why so many of them were supportive.
So Dave, what made you want to pursue a PhD to begin with? I mean, did you feel like that was necessary to get a job at the USDA, or did you feel like, did you have a lot of people in your family that had graduate degrees? And so that was something that was encouraged within your family, or was that, you know, what kind of, because I know when I went to graduate school, I knew nothing about what it was. I thought it was going to be undergrad 2.0 and it wasn't. And so, but nobody really prepared me for that. So what was it that kind of drove you to pursue a PhD to begin with?
So I know what the final push was. I'm not sure I can pinpoint exactly what was the initial push from the standpoint. In my family, my parents didn't go to college, but I have an older sister. I have two younger sisters, and my older sister, about 2 years ahead of me, and so she was going to grad school. And we would talk quite a bit, but I don't think it was an influence of, oh, she's doing it, I think I should do it. I don't think there was that. But I my sister has always been very easy to talk to about these types of things, particularly as we've gotten older and we share, you know, academic careers. I think when I was younger, I think my family thought, we're not sure that he can succeed in college. And yeah, which is funny, but at the same time, I mean, I provided them opportunity to have their doubts, I suppose. I mean, I didn't take high school overly seriously. I didn't blow it off. It's just that I didn't necessarily enjoy the academic experience of high school. And I would say in part because my teachers weren't necessarily overly excited about what they were doing. I had one that was, and he was the most influential because he was the biology teacher, and he was not necessarily a great inspirer of students in terms of biology, but he loved to do research, and I loved to do science fair, and he encouraged me to do it. And that's all that I needed. I didn't need a lot more than that. I think I've always been pretty good of having self-motivation, even if I am kind of rudderless at times. It's okay because I enjoy trying things and they don't fail. I don't really stay down too long and try to build off that experience. So as an undergrad, when it became apparent to me that I really love doing research, I started asking the questions of my academic advisor. And I had two research advisors. Where can you go with this? Because I knew that they loved to do research, but their teaching was so time consuming, they didn't get to do the research they wanted. So that was part of the reason I wasn't thinking going academia originally. And the USDA became really high on my focus because they told me, here's a place that you can do research with people who have the same type of interest that you do. And I liked working with insects as experimental models at that point. And I got to do research all day. So then I started looking up, well, then what are the qualifications? And almost every job I came across indicated you had to have a PhD. So I just said, okay, by sophomore year, then it was in my head, I'm going to go that direction. Not really, kind of like you, Mike, not really knowing what does that mean. I mean, outside of talking to a professor, I didn't know anybody else that had been to grad school. So naively, I don't know if I knew that it was going to be like undergrad, but I definitely didn't care because the idea was I was going to get to take entomology courses and most of my time was going to be spent working on my research for my thesis. That sounded like a win across the board to me. So I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to be a strong enough student. Doesn't make any difference because the research is going to make up for it. And I kind of went from there. So somewhere around sophomore year, I had had that epiphany that this is where I want to go. I was never a student who ever thought, like so many that I've taught, that I wanted to go into healthcare or medicine. That never at any point crossed my mind, and don't regret it in any way, shape, or form. And it was never a matter of, do I have the grades to do it? I did have the grades to do it, but human biology was not exciting to me. And in fact, one of the things that Ball State did when I was a student is your first 2 years, pre-med students did not take classes with the what you would, I guess you would call true bio majors. We were all bio majors, but you didn't start overlapping until junior year. So I never had conversations, I guess, when I was most impressionable about, hey, you should think about being a doctor. I mean, it never came up. No interest whatsoever. So, yeah. So it was one of those things that, you know, it was kind of like you took the courses, you had the experiences that you connected with. So then I looked to find out, well, what else do I need to do to be able to do this all the time? That's what led to the PhD idea.
One thing I didn't comment on in your background, you were in the National Guard too. So did that play a role in any of your decision making, or was that to afford college, or, you know, why did you go that route as well?
That was my option to be able to go to college outside of my hometown. You know, we had a regional campus that was in the town where I grew up. They did technically offer biology, but I knew from science fair experiences, because that's where we always held the local science fair, that no one there did research. So, I mean, it was already on my radar that, you know, and in my mind, I didn't know what research was going in as an undergrad. I was thinking, hey, science fair, you know, but to be able to go out of the area, my parents were divorced. They didn't have much money. And they said, if you're going to do anything, you're going to have to figure out a way to do it, but we don't think you will. And I got introduced to a National Guard recruiter, and it's like, okay, I can move out of my city. So I did that. And what I will say is it was probably the best prep for going to college I could have done, because I did basic training 2 weeks after I graduated from high school. And I came back 9-10 weeks later and probably grew up by about 5 years as a result of that. So my motivation for succeeding as an undergrad radically changed from that. I have a feeling had I not done that, I probably would have been just one of those students that kind of went with the flow for the first couple of years and took some time to finally reach what I want to do. And I could have missed out on those research opportunities. So it was a really good thing for me. So, yeah. So I did that for 9 years before I got out. And by the time that I got out, I was married. So my wife was kind of nervous because we were in Desert Storm my last year that I was actually in, and I had been activated. And so my wife's like, I can't handle this anymore. So I'm like, okay, I don't have to continue. So that's fine.
So what advice, now looking back on your career, what advice would you give your younger self? Like, is there anything that you feel like you could have done differently that would have kind of changed the trajectory of your career?
You know, that's an interesting thing. Would I have wanted my career to be different than what it is today?
Right.
And I don't know that I would necessarily, because my intent was to go into a career that was heavily involved in research, which would have been, I would have loved. But I will say that the path that I went down opened up my personality quite a bit, from being very introverted to being at least force extroverted to teach. And, you know, and I think that's something that a lot of folks who've gone into the sciences have experienced to some degree. And had I stayed with my original path, then I think that so much of my life could have been just one dimensional, that I don't know that I would necessarily want to have a different path. What advice would I give myself, though, is to get involved in the department earlier, to get involved in doing research, or to talk about it earlier than I even did. And I started talking as a freshman, but it was a great experience. And I think so many times that students who go through wait until, oh, you start having these conversations senior year, maybe junior year. Don't, no. No, my experience was so much richer, because by the time that I was a sophomore, most of the faculty in my department knew my name, and there was 20 some faculty. And in that particular case, unlike today, I think it was much more in a positive vein than it is in my own department sometimes. But no, I mean, getting involved, I think, is so important, because it shaped my career decision. the coursework didn't do it. It was the experience of research that really is what solidified the path that I wanted to go down. And if I said anything to myself, this self to then, I would say going in to college the first day is to stick to it. Ask for opportunities to get into the lab. Don't take no for an answer, you know, and get involved. And, you know, that's what I did, but I delayed it a little bit longer. And I would recommend that to any student that's going to college.
As I hear you talking and thinking about our listeners, well, I hope there's more than one listener. So I'm going to say plural listeners.
Right now there's podcast. Three. But
the three of us will be listening to it over and over. One thing that I think might surprise people is that while working at a small liberal arts college, you've been talking a lot about research, and actually our division of labor is supposed to be 50% teaching, you know, 30 to 40% research, and then the remainder is service. So do you feel like you're able to achieve that, or do you shift back and forth, or is that completely wrong in how you think your time is divided up?
Well, I think you and I are on the same page here that there's not a distinction between teaching and research in the grand scheme of things. So we are in the pursuit of knowledge and sharing that knowledge. And there's many ways that you actually do that. But where there's incredible research taking place, it's at the very basic level or at institutions that are fully focused on undergraduate education. Because for the most part, you can peel back the pressures that a professor that might be at a Research One institution has of, I have to generate grant money to support what we're trying to do. And ultimately, those individuals usually lose the opportunity for joy because they become an administrator of a lab and not the opportunity to get to do the research like that they once dreamed that they were going to. It's really a vicious cycle that you get into because you are a hotshot investigator that gets the opportunity to stop being a hotshot investigator. So there's plenty of opportunity to get involved in research, and incredible opportunity to also bring an arsenal of students into the laboratory to ask questions that you don't have to worry about what the end results actually are. You can ask these questions out of just general curiosity. And if it turns into a publication, fantastic, which, you know, I've been fortunate a lot of times it does. But we can ask the question because a student walks in and says, why don't we actually set something up and take a look at that? And it's not that expensive that we can easily do it. And if we hit, then we can consider going for a grant or a publication or whatever it might be. So there's a lot of research going on. And I think that I wouldn't have known that when I was a student that was looking for schools to go. But it's really clear. I mean, this is not just a unique blip at Loyola. It's something that colleagues I've talked to have had this similar type of experiences as well. And I think for anyone who's thinking about a career of, I'd really like to do research, well, you know, a small or a medium-sized school might be exactly what you're looking for, depending upon the type of research that you want to do as well. And I would not have known that as a junior or senior as an undergrad.
So David, looking at your career, you've had a kind of a major shift where early on you were doing work with wasps, venom, and now you've shifted over to forensics and forensic entomology. How was that a challenge to do that, to make that shift? And, you know, I also know you're a fan of Sherlock Holmes. Did that play into your interest in forensics? And, you know, what are some of the takeaways that you have from making that kind of career shift?
Well, actually, it's not a shift at all. It just looks like it to the novice, but that's okay. Don't take it personally. The central theme of everything that I've ever done that dates back to even when I was a freshman in high school was that I wound up working with insects. What I didn't know in high school is that I liked working with the insects. At that time, I was doing genetics questions. And I actually understood the life history of the insect far better than I understood the genetics, but it took me 3 more years to figure that out. So when I started doing research as an undergrad, then I had asked to actually work in a couple of different labs. And the individual that said yes to me was my animal zoology instructor, who happened to be an entomologist. I was not looking for an entomologist to work with, but he was looking for someone to do research with him. And he was very excited that I said I wanted to work with him, which I still don't recall ever saying, I want to work with you. But I could not have had a better mentor at all. I mean, he just, he was fantastic. And, but that whole window of time. So, I mean, there's a couple of things that are taking place. One, I'm working with insects at every level. And two, so I had always been intrigued by asking questions and seeking the answers. It just so happens that I was a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes, but the wanting to seek the answers was there before that I connected it with my interest in Holmes, you know, and other aspects. So as an undergrad moving into a grad lab, I actually was working with bacterial toxins before that I did a shift after a year and a half towards a lab that was doing ecophysiology with flies. And I wasn't as intrigued by the flies as much as I was that there was this remote project that no one in the lab wanted to do, but my graduate advisor really wanted somebody to do. And I'm always interested a little bit in the, you know, the off path and doing something that nobody else would actually do. So as I looked into it, it moved towards looking at parasitic wasp venoms, but that was not his original idea. After I had done about 6 months worth of experiments, I realized his initial premise was not completely on the mark. And it really came down to looking at these venoms. Well, that wasp parasitizes flies that are forensically important. The lab that was doing all the ecophysiology was working with flies that were forensically important. So really what was happening this whole time is I was doing basic research that was all forensically related, but we weren't calling it forensics at the time. In the 90s, there were very few people that actually said anything about forensic entomology. Mm-hmm. And so my interest had been developed. I knew that it existed. And it was really by being able to come to a school like Loyola where you could ask the questions that you wanted to in your research lab, and you had the chance to maybe develop courses based upon student interest, that we could really start dipping our toes into, hey, what could we do in forensics? What might be interesting to the students? And next thing you know, it led to a research program. It led to an undergraduate program. And now, as Chris mentioned before, it's a graduate program that existed as well. But there was always a linkage there. I may not have always known it clearly in my mind, but it was there. So now, if you're just saying practically, you're asking these series of questions, and now you're shifting over to what seems to be radically different. It's an easy transition if you want to do it. Meaning my motivation was always there. I wasn't never worried about whether it'd be successful, because that wasn't really the goal in the first place. The goal was I get to ask questions that I really want to ask. And, you know, because if I'm asking good questions, the success of that project is always dependent upon the energy I'm willing to put into it. Well, I already knew that I was going to put everything into it. So there was nothing, no trepidation whatsoever in doing that. And I don't mean for that to seem like overconfidence. It's just, you know, it's easy to make that type of transition when you're more of a senior faculty member, because you've already kind of laid a foundation knowing what works, what doesn't work, and kind of how to adapt in the career environment that you're in. And I made that adaptation after being here about 15 years. So I didn't have the pressure of worrying about tenure and promotion being dependent upon the success of the projects leading to publications or anything. I had those. So right. This was just fun. And the students were really into it. And I thought, let's go all in, because this is fun.
I'm glad you clarified all that, because to me, the theme running through everything was not the insects or the questions you were asking. As I look at venom and then forensics and Jack the Ripper, Holmes, Poe, it all came back to death. So I was really worried about what your plans were long-term for just trying to commit the perfect murder or whatever you were trying to do. So glad to hear it was kind of an altruistic mechanism.
No one has said at any point that the perfect murder isn't on the table. It's just that it doesn't have to be a research objective.
Valid point. So I think I have one last question I think that I would like to ask. And, you know, you've articulated a lot of really great things that you have achieved and that you've been able to achieve at Loyola for you and your students. As you look forward, what do you see the biggest needs are in this field or in a career like being a small college professor, or what kind of cutting edge changes are you hoping to see in research or teaching?
So I'm not sure if you're looking for a short answer there, Chris, because that's that's not a short one necessarily.
No, it's not. But,
So let's just take a look at the forensic side of things just for a second, because forensics is certainly in the limelight constantly in 2021, and it has been for a while. And oftentimes it has been in the limelight for negative reasons, particularly for wrongful convictions and for concern about corruption that's associated with how the forensic science has been used. There is a need for really good students that are talented with their hands when it comes to the forensic sciences, that have the ethical training and that have the motivation to actually do things the right way, meaning seeking truth no matter which side of the law that you're actually working for, whether it's for the prosecution, for the defense. We have an absolute need to have individuals go into that. And there's a need then for programs that are of high quality to be able to prepare students for those by putting the science in forensic science. This has been on the radar in the United States since 2009, when the National Academy of Sciences report came out. And there's been quite a few very positive changes that have taken place, but there's also areas that changes have not taken place. And while this may not have exactly the same growth potential as some other careers, there is always a need for talented students that are going through these programs, because that's what we absolutely need. And particularly in the challenging areas where that we need to develop statistical models to be able to look at tough areas, like in the comparative sciences, where that we don't have the right paradigms yet for being able to say, what kind of probability do I have about this fingerprint of being a match? Or if I'm talking ballistics or question documents, wherever it's going to be, that's an area I continue to try to work in. And that's an area that I try to mentor students to go into. That's very, very important. And, you know, me, like you, the both of you, I'm very interested in students being able to see careers that may not be on their radar right out of the gate. In some sense, that's now become the college professor or the academic position, which it used to be that if someone said, hey, you should go to grad school and get your PhD, well, what they think you were going to do, they thought you were going to go and become a college professor. Right. Now, it's considered bad advice to tell somebody to actually do that because the market's kind of dried up in one sense. But it's kind of the same outlook that forensics has. There's an absolute need for outstanding individuals to go into this because we need great teachers. We need great researchers. The tools that are available to researchers to do biomedical research are more sophisticated than ever, which means that they probably aren't available to everyone because that takes someone who's very talented to be able to use those and apply those to very tough questions as well. So, you know, the careers are limitless in one sense, but only if you know that they exist. And the work of bionavigators is really shining light on careers that people have not paid attention to in the past. I've never understood that, but you know, I was in that same mode. I didn't know that they existed. So that's a role that I have, is to try to help students see these in forensics, out of forensics, the whole career field that they actually have, and keep pushing for that, because it's tougher now to get jobs too. So even though there's limitless jobs, it's tougher. So this kind of mentoring is just absolutely essential.
Yeah. And I think one of the themes that you can see with your career is that you've been very proactive in terms of taking control and trying to try new things and get out of your comfort zone a little bit and, you know, meet your mentors that have kind of helped you along your way. And I think that's the message that, you know, we like to try and share with our students as well of, you know, you have to kind of get out there and try stuff and, you know, and be proactive and kind of take control. And so I think that's, you know, something that kind of shines through, I think, from what you have said today. We want to thank you, Dave, for taking the time to speak to Microbios. It's our first podcast, so we're excited to have you. I mean, I was excited. You know, you've always been a mentor of me for the last 25 years, let's say that. So we appreciate you taking the time today, and thank you for all you do for the students as well. So, Chris, anything else?
Thank you very much. You've been a mentor to me for a long time as well. I'm much, much younger than Mike though, so you haven't mentored me nearly as long, but thank you so much. This was a great conversation, and I think it'll help a lot of students.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And I think the work that you guys are doing is fantastic. So I hope a lot of students will pay attention to the advice that you're sharing and actually, you know, be innovative in paving their own path rather than following someone else's.